This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meat and Three, we're talking about comfort food as we explore its history, meaning, and different interpretations from around the world.
Donburi is just a simple, casual dish, but it's packed with the history.
Somebody might have their comfort food be something that they remember eating at their friend's house, but they would never have at their own home. Consuming foods that were eaten then can bring back some of those feelings from those times.
It's about creating these little breaks and moments during the day where you kind of feel present.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Hey, Greg, how you doing today, buddy?
Whew. I am still here. How about you, man?
Well, I think honestly, for the first time throughout COVID, for sure, I can say that I feel a sense of relief.
Yes.
A collective sigh of relief washed over certainly New York, and it appears the rest of the country, and frankly, it looks like the world on Saturday when we got some pretty positive news for the first time in over 8 months, and possibly some of the best news we've gotten in 4 years.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, we've all been through a lot since the last time you and I were in the virtual studio. And obviously we have a lot to talk about. In fact, we just got some breaking news about bars as we sat down to record the show. But let's eat dessert first today, because I feel like we've earned it. You know, where were you at 11:28 a.m. this past Saturday? And what did you do?
Well, let's see. I was in bed. I typically set my alarm on mornings after I worked the night before for 11:30. So my alarm hadn't even gone off yet. However, you know, I'm as a business operator, I have to be connected all the time. So my phone is just by the bed, and I'll ignore a ping. I'll ignore a couple of pings. But suddenly, my phone was rattling and pinging and vibrating off the table. So I obviously. My first thoughts, of course, were terrible things like, oh, you know, the country's on fire.
Your phone going off means now, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, for this period, it's meant that. But I was elated to see that friends, family, coworkers, my partner was one of the first to text me. Ravi texted me just to say, you know, they just announced. So Biden-Harris, you know, announced the winners. On Saturday, of course, it's being contested, and of course, that's kind of de rigueur for politics today. But it looks, you know, like it's an overwhelming victory that's not going to be overturned. You know, we're not going to be sitting on pins and needles until December 12th, like we were back in 2000. So, you know, yeah, I was in bed, so it was a pleasant way to wake up. Where were you?
I was also having a little bit of a lion. My girlfriend Mandy had just left for work, so I was like. You know, I mean, the last week had just been so draining that I was like, all right, I should get up. I should make myself breakfast. I should work out. I should take a shower, et cetera. So I should do basic human being shit. But I was just so drained. I was sitting there. I think I was watching Stephen Colbert on YouTube. And all of a sudden out my window, because it was a beautiful fucking day here in New York, I started to hear people like going, woo, woo, and like car horns. And that was when I was like, I'm going to refresh this New York Times news page just to see if this is what I think it is. And it was.
For the 1 millionth time, right?
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah, I flipped over the counter to 1 million refreshes, and that was the one that did it. But I live on the fourth floor of my building, so I ran up to the roof, and I just sort of stood there like Rose on the Titanic, just like, you know, arms out, just basking in this wave of cheers and car horns. And like you said, just relief. It was so great. Then I took a bottle of cider down to the ground floor out in front of my building. The guys at the coffee shop below me were spraying around a bunch of champagne like they're LeBron James after the finals. Like, it was just a good day. And I feel like we had almost forgotten what good news feels like, and it was really nice to just be like, ah, this is as nice as I remember it being, you know?
Yeah, I mean, same. You know, I'm over here in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Yeah, lots of pots and pans banging, just like it is every night at 7 o'clock for the frontline workers. And yeah, not only was it a piece of good news, which is a tasty morsel that we haven't been fed enough lately. I also feel that since then, because today is Wednesday, I feel that since then, I haven't simply been bombarded with news. I feel like it's suddenly somewhat quiet, are we past the storm, or is this just the eye? I don't know. But right now, I don't feel compelled to check the news. I don't feel, what's happening now? That sense of dread every time you open up your email or get a text from someone, I feel, at least for the moment, it's calm.
I know. It feels like we've just been letting the garbage in the apartments of our minds pile up and pile up and pile up and pile up, and finally the garbage man finally showed up and it's gone now, and it's kind of like, wow, it's nice in here and it's clean, and look at all this space. I never had all this space in here before.
Little decluttering.
Yeah, very much needed mental decluttering for sure.
And then now to so that was dessert first. Where do we go from there? A spoonful of castor oil. So just before the show started today, I got about 30 texts in a matter of 3 minutes. Apparently now New York is being we're slowly starting to phase backwards due to numbers rising, COVID. So starting Friday, today's Wednesday, so starting Friday, all bars and restaurants in New York have to close by 10 p.m. That's backing us up by an hour, and actually in some ways 2 hours. If you're doing any indoor seating, indoors at 25% has been allowed to go until midnight, whereas outdoor on the street side has only been allowed to go till 11. Now it's 10 for across the board. So another blow to the industry being levied today in the face of the pandemic. And, everyone has their opinions, of course, and the sides that they fall on, and I've made it pretty clear across the board that mine has always been, I still don't think we should be here at all, but I'm forced to be here because the government deems me essential, which I cannot wrap my mind around how alcohol is essential. It's certainly something I enjoy, but I don't think I would die without it. But because they deem me essential, then my landlord says, well, the government says you can open, and if you can open, you can pay me. And I say, well, I don't want to open, and the landlord says, well, you still got to pay me. So I'm trapped. And that's how I stand on it. And we got one of my very good friends, neighbor, and also a business operator, hanging out with us in the virtual studio today. And he wants to get in on this conversation and throw some hands. Welcome to the room, Joaquin Simo. Good to see you. Good to hear you anyway. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing much better now. I have to say, after Saturday, there was a pretty massive dose of relief. I think I, like many of us in New York City, had a pretty hell of a great party last Saturday. Well, it coincided with my birthday.
Exactly. I was going to say, coupled with your birthday, like what a great gift America gave you.
I got, for my 43rd birthday, I got a 46th president, and I was very, very excited about that.
Not a bad haul.
No, not bad at all. It was pretty spectacular to wander down the streets of Brooklyn and then Manhattan on my birthday and just feel like 8.5 million people were celebrating with me. You're just walking down the street, people are honking and cheering and screaming with joy. And
literally, we saw many videos, literally dancing in the streets.
Oh, I mean, I took part in a few of those street-side dance parties because, it's my birthday. Hey, let's have a dance party.
Why not?
Yeah, it was freaking great. That was honestly one of the few moments that I think I've been able to look at over the last 8 months now and be like, wow, that was happy. That was like genuinely happy.
Right. Great. Remember what happiness is?
It's been a while. Like
the thorn being pulled from the paw, that
exactly.
You've forgotten what it means to simply not have a dull ache. Joaquin, you and I are pretty good friends, and we've hung out and traveled around together. And you're a good friend of the show. You've been on before. Remind the listener who you are and what you do.
I am the one of the partners at Pouring Ribbons, a cocktail bar in the East Village. It's been around for the last 8 years. Before that, I was at Death & Co. as part of their opening staff. I did about 5.5 years there. And before
I did
that,
about five. It's like a sentence. No. I did my 5 years.
No, you know, I mean, it was.
I did a nickel at Death.
It was a great run, man. I had a blast over there. I wouldn't trade that for the world. But you know, and before that, I'd worked in Boston, in like pubs and rock and roll bars and stuff like that. I usually tell people I learned how to bartend in Boston. I learned how to make drinks in New York.
Yeah, yeah, that adds up to me.
Yeah,
and you're a pretty smart fellow as well, educated man, as it were. Got a degree in both English and religion. That's pretty cool.
I like to read.
Yeah, I think you know. Just a quick side note: Blake Walker, who's the head bartender for me at Amore Amargo, he has a dual degree in music and religion, and I can see some parallels in what he says about, when I asked him why those two things specifically together, and I can see some parallels in what you did as well, and how it's working out for your career. He said I wanted to travel the world, and I knew that anywhere I went, I could talk about either music or religion. So I feel like being able to talk about religion and being able to talk about it well has probably opened a lot of doors for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think if nothing else, people are surprised when someone understands the context around what they're talking about, even if I may not have, you know, this exhaustive knowledge on all facets of what they're doing. I may know enough to ask a good question, and oftentimes that's enough for someone to feel like they're being heard, or for them to then start filling in those blanks for you. You know, it's not about knowing all this stuff. It's kind of knowing what you don't know and knowing how to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what we do when we corral people and drive them through their experience at our bars, right? We try and understand that they don't understand what they want, and that we know, we have the knowledge to get it to them. There's a bridge that has to be gapped though. But I asked you to be on the show because you came into my spot the other day, last week, maybe before your birthday, and you seemed a little, to use your word, you seemed a little salty, and you wanted to talk about some things that are going on. So let's talk about them. And you sent over some notes that are, I think, in pretty good order. So let's go straight down your list here and talk about kind of the breakdown of the profit and loss numbers at your bar, Pouring Ribbons, great bar, and what economic impact a single cocktail bar can have, and then how that's been disrupted so much by the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important when we're looking at these businesses, that they are really businesses, right? I mean, we've been in bars that were packed night in, night out, that, you know, go out of business in 8 months or a year. And you're like, wow, that place was always so busy. What's that? How did they go under? You're like, well, because they weren't profitable, right? And you could be busy and not be profitable. You could be relatively slow and be very profitable. You know, it's a matter of how you control your costs. It's a matter of, I mean, none of that is fun or sexy, but I mean, it's the truth. You know, you can run on what looks like a very busy bar, and that may not translate into your bottom line at all. And I've been very fortunate to have a business partner, Jason Cott, and our bookkeeper, Keith Harmon, and the two of them started a company called Alchemy Financial. And I met Keith, who's a bookkeeper, when he sat at my bar. He was sitting at service, in front of the service well at Death & Co. when I was still working there. And we had a really lovely night. He was such a nice guy. And he said, hey man, if you ever open a bar, I would love to set up your books for you. Because if you get that set up right in the beginning, it sets you up for success long-term. I brought it up to Jason. Those two hit it off. So when it was time to open up Pouring Ribbons, we had, you know, both someone who knew how to set up our books in the best way and a very canny and savvy operator from a business point. So, you know, we've always been pretty open and honest with our staff about what the P&Ls look like. We, Jason, would teach classes for the staff periodically, once or twice a year, about how to read a P&L statement, about how, you know, what are the things like, why do I yell at you guys about putting too many crackers in there? You know, why do we keep reaffirming this? Well, he goes through a P&L statement and teaches them how to read it, which I think is an incredibly important thing and something that, you know, a lot of people can barely read, you know, the recipe sheets, to say nothing of a P&L statement, you know, and make heads or sense of it. So it's a really, really good thing to be able to look at some of these numbers. And when I was looking at our numbers, there were just some things that really stood out to me. And then I had a conversation with Keith yesterday, kind of in preparation for this. So I wanted to talk a little bit more and kind of get a more macro view of these micro numbers that I was looking at. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff in there. Like, I remember thinking just like, what do we do in terms of like payroll tax? Like, how much have we put into something like payroll tax over the last 8 years? And that answer is just under $200,000, which is not a small amount of money. You know, we have spent booze purveyors, whether that's beer, wine, or hard alcohol, we've spent about $1.4 million. When I'm thinking about local businesses like a linens company, pest control, CO2 tanks, printing, flowers and decoration, menu design, that's another $55,000. Just bar produce, lemons, limes, mint, cucumber, et cetera, stuff like that, $200,000. Bar dry goods, $42,000. We've spent $190,000 on our local security firm, $221,000 for our porter services, barware and glassware, which we buy mostly locally, is another $74,000. And to have our trash and our recycling taken out, we've spent just under $60,000 over the last few years. And, you know, if you look at it over 8 years, you're like, oh, okay, well, I can kind of see where that breakdown is. We're one bar. We don't really have like, we don't have like a huge linens need at our bar. We had cheese and charcuterie. So it's not like we had a lot of things like that. We're a relatively small self-contained bar that really just focused on cocktails and ran with a lean staff. And there's 4,500 bars like this in the city. So when you start multiplying this by 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, those numbers start to get huge. And these are the businesses that I feel like are being ignored in this. So I think maybe the first thing I should have said was that I don't, I think first of all, restaurants fall into this category as well. But I feel like restaurants have gotten really, really, really good PR. And I think there's a lot of sympathy around restaurants. I think if you are a mom and pop restaurant, independently run restaurant, I feel like there's been a lot of attention put on your plight. And I think that's totally valid. And I am 1,000% support of all of that. What I was so salty about was that there are bars that don't have kitchens. There are bars that don't serve food, right? There are nightclubs. There are performance venues. There are performance art spaces and art venues that don't serve food. And they have been left completely out in the cold in this.
Because under the new mandate, you have to serve food.
Right.
And if those places don't have the facilities to do that, what's the impetus for creating those facilities, which are, again, going to be a cost, just to carry on? So we're seeing a lot of them just fall by the wayside.
A lot of them. And I think, look, I get that, you know, not every business is going to survive this. But I feel like what's been making me increasingly upset is that there doesn't seem to be anyone who seems to be lamenting the loss of bars and clubs and like nightlife in general. And I think that is a huge, huge, huge mistake. And so I wanted to kind of talk about why I think that's such a mistake. And I wanted to highlight a couple things about like even my own small bar. And Pouring Ribbons has done well over the years, you know, but we're not one of those bars that was like packed to the gills every night. We weren't like an EO or something like that where it was just always busy. You could walk into our bar and be like, oh, it's kind of quiet in here. You know, it's a Tuesday. It's not going to be that busy. You know, and maybe that Thursday was going to be much busier. Right? Or the weekends were generally fine. But I mean, we weren't a bar that was like packed to the gills every night. Like we were a, you know, pretty successful bar who did well, but I mean, we weren't jam packed. So this isn't, I don't want any of these numbers to be like, oh, well, that's some super aspirational stuff. I think our numbers were pretty achievable.
yeah, modest and achievable for sure.
I just want to make sure that that's clear, that I don't think that this is something that is crazy aspiration. I mean, we can't all do what some of those bars that are just so busy all the time are. And I think it's unfair always to hold yourself to that standard. So it's not that, but I feel like we have done pretty damn well over the last 8 years. And it doesn't look like there's a really good roadmap towards us coming back unless we, have to institute a food program of some sorts. And I'm terrified of doing that because the DOH is just going to come in and find the shit out of us for whatever it is we're doing wrong now with food, and what the issues will be with that. So that just seems punitive. And not to mention, we'd have to upgrade 100+ years buildings, filtration and HVAC. We have less than 2 years left on our lease. That's kind of a considerable expense to be putting in. So I feel like there's, when I start thinking about like, what is the roadmap for coming back, you know, that's not entirely clear. And then also when I start thinking about, you know, what's happening in terms of, you know, we have no storefront in the front. We can't really use the outside to do anything. We don't have the frontage for it. We have no outdoor space otherwise. Indoor dining at 25%. We don't have food. And 25% is just not worth it. And then we still have to make those upgrades that I talked about. So it's a little frightening for me as an operator who's done well, that this is all going to seemingly go away and no one seems to care. And it's not just, yeah, it's not just bars, also these other venues. And that is so important. And I feel like it's, we talk a lot about like, damn, that Thai restaurant closed, or, oh, my favorite taco spot closed. You're like, what about that really cool club that you used to go to? It was the one where you met like a whole different set of friends that you would have never met anywhere else. Like, there's real value in that.
Joaquin, I feel like that's going to come later. People currently in New York and probably everywhere that are having to deal with these sorts of lockdowns due to this terrible crisis that we're facing are still, you know, somewhat ordering food. You know, you eat every day. You don't necessarily drink every day like me, but they're ordering the food, and they aren't grappling with the reality that their restaurants aren't coming back yet. And what we're going to see, I think, is when we are allowed to be back to some sort of capacity that does make it worth it for a bar like yours to reopen, and you know, maybe not make it, that's when people are going to lament. It's going to be too late. They don't know it yet. They don't feel it yet. They don't sense it yet. This is a moment we need to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. But when we come back, we're going to keep talking about Joaquin and his very raw transparency about what's going on through all of this stuff. So stay tuned. There's plenty more to come.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
And we're back. You were listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking with a giant of the bar industry, Joaquin Simo, And before we left, we were talking a little bit about how these places are kind of being left. A lot of the spots that we've been talking about, you know, bars, nightclubs, music venues, performance spaces, are being left in a lot of ways to wither on the vine. And I want to ask you to speculate a little bit here, Joaquin, about why that is. You know, it's like you were saying, it's like people always get upset when their favorite, you know, taco joint or their favorite Thai place closes down. And yet there doesn't seem to be the same level of concern for these other types of third places. And I want to ask you to, you know, put on your sociologist hat for a second and sort of talk a little bit about why that might be.
Well, I think the obvious thing is that you can still get a taco to go. You can still get, you know, your khao soi, you know, and that's okay, but you can't go dancing, right? So it's not even, people aren't thinking like, oh, well, I can go do this or I can do that. Like, they're not necessarily thinking that that's even a possibility. So I think it's a little bit of out of sight, out of mind. And I want to be absolutely clear here. I don't think that we should be opening up bars and nightclubs right now. I don't think they're a safe environment to be in. I really and truly, like, I'm not doing indoor dining, as in I'm not going to restaurants and eating indoors, because it frightens me.
Yeah, nor am I. Absolutely agree.
It absolutely frightens me. And that's one of the reasons why I'm very reluctant to reopen the bar, is because if I am terrified to be in a restaurant for an hour and a half, then how do I turn to my staff and say, hey, why don't you go in there and do a 10-hour shift? I that doesn't ring well, you know, that doesn't sit well with me. And so I get that. And I'm not advocating a reopening of these places before there's a vaccine or until we have, you know, a certain level of like, we can let people be near each other again, because these are environments that are designed for human interaction. That is their entire reason for existing, is to force people together, right? And I get that that's incredibly responsible right now. So again, the reason I'm angry is not because I think that we should be able to go dancing right now at our favorite nightclubs. I'm upset because I feel like every time that bars or nightclubs even get mentioned, which is nearly never, by politicians, by media members, it's always with this sneering disdain. It's always mm-hmm. with this just like, oh, those dens of iniquity. Ugh, it's just where people go to ruin their lives. It's like, that's not fair. That is not remotely fair. And the reason is our economic impact doesn't bear that out. We are not just dens of iniquity. And even if we were, these dens of iniquity are contributing huge, huge numbers to our economy. So it doesn't make sense to want to close these places down and not have them come back, because right now we're looking at an enormous, enormous economic impact during a time where we've already seen so many businesses go down. I mean, if you're looking at nightlife just in New York City, there's more than 25,000 nightlife establishments that supported around 300,000 jobs, $13 billion in employee compensation, and $35 billion in total economic output. That yielded almost $700 million in tax revenue per year. Okay, you can do a lot of work on the L train with $700 million in tax revenue. All right, like, that's not a small thing. You know, this is an enormous amount of people who work. We're a city of 8.5 million people. There's a lot of people who are working in food service, in bars, in the arts, in venues, in sports and recreation, which even includes stuff like bowling alleys and pool halls and stuff like that. So, I mean, all of these things are wrapped up under this nightlife impact. And it is, you know, $6.2 billion, $7.4 billion in employee compensation, another $19 billion in economic output. Here, we're looking at ancillary impacts on New York City's economy, right? There's additional spending on things like retail, transportation, hotels, and other lodging. You have a bunch of other things where people are coming to the city to go, be able to go to these bars, to be able to go to these clubs that are able, you know, to go to these performance spaces. That is where that all comes from, right? I mean, if you're looking at losing nearly $2 billion in tax revenues to New York City and state, whether that's employee taxes, sales taxes, liquor taxes, hotel taxes, I mean, you are looking at billions of dollars at a time when everyone is saying, hey, the city coffers are running dry. What are we going to do? Well, here's a good idea. Maybe you don't ignore one of your most lucrative drivers of revenue. I don't think that's crazy. I mean, I'm not saying go pack a nightclub right now, but we should be talking about what we can be doing to help support these places so that when it's safe for them to reopen, they still exist and their staff and their bills have been able to have been paid and met over this time so that when it's safe, we can still have these things because they're really, really, really important. And so like that, when we're looking at those numbers, I mean, that just, it blows me out of the water that they can so callously disregard us in public when you actually start looking at what that economic impact is, you realize how critical we really are, you know, and that's just pure numbers. That's not even like, oh, well, you know, I met my girlfriend at a club once, you know, like I'm not talking about like some hazy memory of a good time back in the day. I'm talking about like real numbers that are based on like what we need. And right now, like the city is in dire need of revenue. And, you know, we can't ignore these businesses that are able to provide it in so many different ways and that have such an inordinate impact on the city's global reputation as well.
I feel like, and the further away we get from being able to come back strong and healthy and go back to business, the further away we get from it, the harder it's going to be to do when we are allowed. So when those restrictions are finally lifted, when consumer confidence is finally high enough to pack into a small bar like mine or a more spacious bar like yours, when those things are ready to happen, are the businesses going to be fiscally healthy enough or are they going to be, you know, ready to jump back in and turn the lights back on? You know, everything went off like a light switch. It's going to be more like a dimmer switch to turn everything back on.
Exactly. Yeah, it's going to be really, really tricky. And I don't think that there's an easy way out of this for really any industry. I think we're all going to be recovered. This has affected us all in ways that the impact of this, we won't even know until, you know, a few years from now when we're really able to look back with any sort of clarity. But it's enormous, the amount of small businesses that have been shuttered permanently already as a result of this is terrifying. I mean, there's so many little businesses that you've already just seen. Where was this stat? It was terrible. Because it was a Yelp stat that I found. As of August in New York, there were that were rated as bars and nightclubs. There were 6,451 that had closed on the Yelp platform that were listed as closed, with 54 of those saying they were closed permanently. I mean, that's a lot of businesses. If you're looking at more than 3,000 of these that have already shuttered and we're only 8 months in and no one has any idea when a vaccine is coming, I mean, those numbers are already past a critical point. I mean, that is a...
Agreed. And we're also sitting, you know, on the edges of our seat waiting for a vaccine to come, but we're sitting on the edges of those seats like we're at the movie theater where the vaccine comes and then it's a sunny day. You know, to create it, to manufacture it, to build that many doses, to package that many doses, to put them into trucks and planes and cars and deliver them, to actually administer them. Like we're, even if it was today it was approved, we're still a year away from getting it into everybody's veins.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we're planning accordingly. You know, we're looking for that magic wand to wave and have it all sort of just be over.
I mean, I wish we could wish it away. I wish it was that easy where, you know, someone clicks their heels three times and all of a sudden, you know, we're we're not in COVID land anymore. But that's just not the case.
I think the president's been doing that every morning for the past 8 months.
Yeah. And look at how well that's gone.
I mean, Joaquin, you pulled up that stat from Yelp and, you know, I keep referring back to an article from the NRA, the good one, the National Restaurant Association, where they predicted a couple of months ago, they predicted that by January, 85% of all sole proprietorships in the hospitality sector will be closed by January. And at first I thought, that seems crazy, that's egregious, that's over the top. And then I looked at my own portfolio where I've closed 4 of my 5 bars since January. I'm back down to just 1. 4 out of 5, that's 80%. I'm right in the pocket of that statistic. So, you know, it's brutal. And you're right, it's made you salty, it's made me salty. And, you know, I feel like we're not being paid enough attention or getting enough relief. And I feel, as you've kind of outlined so far, that it already is causing lots of problems. But even when it's time to restart this engine and start driving revenue again, we're not going to be ready because we haven't been supported. I feel currently like I'm simply marching off to the fight, and I'm exhausted from the march, and I haven't even arrived at the fight.
God, it's just exhausting, isn't it? So you just said you've closed 4 out of 5 venues. So that's 4 fewer P&Ls that you have to go over. But if you were to look at those P&Ls, this is what you'd be finding out is now missing due to 4 out of those 5 going under, right? So it's hard to just look at a P&L and kind of, it's never going to fully capture the economic and social impact of a small business. So if we just want to look at a breakdown of how each dollar of sales on an income statement translates into local and national economies, and how kind of those monies are deployed, right? So for every dollar of sales that would be on the P&L of one of your 5 establishments, you would have had 25 cents of that would have probably gone to roughly cost of goods sold, right? And a good chunk of that would have been, the purchasing of that would have been biased towards local vendors.
Yep.
And hopefully things like responsible and sustainable producers, which are supporting their local economies as well. So, I mean, it's the difference between picking, you know, the biggest brand versus a smaller boutique brand, a local farm versus, you know, big agriculture. You know, small businesses like ours end up working with smaller local producers far more often. So we are an integral cog in that supply chain, right?
Small businesses are inclined to work with small businesses.
That makes perfect sense
to me.
So, I mean, we're already helping other small businesses exist simply by us being in operation, right? So that's the first quarter. Another 25 cents goes to payroll. Obviously, those are local residents, right? So you're putting money directly into the pockets of people who will then spend it locally. Another 20 cents in tips, right? So that's a transfer of funds from customers facilitated by the hospitality business, again, going into the pockets of people who will be spending locally. And, you know, some percentage of that will go directly to the nearest dive bar across the street at the end of every shift. Yeah. It's a very quick and effective local transfer of monies. You have another 3 cents in employment taxes, right? And that goes to support Social Security, Medicare, state and federal unemployment funds, right? You have 12 and change cents that are going into local and national taxes that are paid by employees. So, you know, that is roughly 5% local taxes of pro forma, 20% federal, right? When you're looking at Social Security, you're looking at Medicare rates, all of that. So another like 12-ish cents goes to there. Roughly 10 cents goes to your landlord. You know, hopefully you're not doing more than 10% of your costs on rent. You then have state sales tax in New York is 8.875%. So that's just under 9 cents out of every dollar. And then you have another 20 cents that are going to other venues in the direct operating, admin, and kind of like general repairs and maintenance, advertising and sales, kind of promotion buckets. I mean, these are generally, you're working with people in your community, right? And then
even you at Boring Ribbons, I know that you used to hire one of your own employees to do the design work on your menus, right? So
yeah, absolutely. We had Amanda Elder for the first few years who was doing, well, the original design work had been done by Warren Red, which is a local design firm. And then Amanda Elder, who was part of our opening staff and was with us for 4 years, was also a graphic designer, so she did all the maintenance and the upkeep. And when we switched to the themed menu, she was the one who did the first few of the themed menus. And then we had Rachel Galea, who was another staffer of ours, who's also a graphic designer, who then took over in that role for us. I mean, we've certainly operated locally. I mean, it was under our own roof.
Right.
So that was great. And then really what that leaves you is you have about another like 7.5 cents, and you know, that's your profit. You know, it's not, it's yeah. not a ton there out of that dollar.
That's the big reveal to everybody who wants to go into this business, right?
Can we just puncture this myth of bar and nightclub owners being these like hospitality Scrooge McDucks? I have never once come home and dove into a giant pool of money. It has never happened. It has just never happened. I don't know any bar owners who routinely do this. Like,
this past Saturday for your birthday, not just one time.
Not even then, you know, like we just don't. Like, we have, for our business model, our net profit, we're on 18-19%, which is high for our business. For making craft cocktails, which is expensive to make, like, we have great margins on that for our business. That's really, really solid. But at the end of the day, what that really translates into is roughly 7.5% profits. I mean, at the end of the day, you could be doing everything right. You could have a reasonably busy bar. You could have a really efficient, great, cost-effective business model that allows you to make very strong margins, and you're still not, at the end of the day, making a ton of money. But if we ignore where that just that dollar is, for every dollar in sales in a small business, there's almost $1.32 in economic activity created. Okay, that is a very, very, very big kind of difference there, right? Because small businesses, at each decision point, they tend to choose those local, responsible, decent trade partners, right? Like, that's who we're doing business with, right? We're not just simply saying, who can get me stuff the cheapest, right? There are times where we're spending more because we believe in the people with whom we want to do business with, right? And so we spend more even if we know that there's a cheaper way of doing it, right? It is more expensive to have a shirt made on 37th Street in the garment district than it is to have it made in Southeast Asia and shipped around the world, right? I mean, but there are some people who would rather have their shirts made on 37th Street, and it's simply going to be a more expensive shirt, or your profit margin is going to go down, right? So, I mean, this is an important thing when we think about where that money is going to end up, right? Because the more of it that ends up in just kind of these big bland multinationals, then that money doesn't have that same trickle-down effect in our own local economies, right? So in that sales dollar, 45 cents of it goes to local employees, roughly 24 cents goes to tax agencies, and that helps to support social safety nets and other functions. 45 cents goes into other small local businesses, and you have another like 17.5 cents of it that goes to owners, if you're thinking about a landlord and a business owner together who are partners in this space, right? One of them owns it, the other one operates it. So in a perfect world, you know, the landlord and the business owner are not adversarial. They are, you know, you have a space, I have an idea, you know, we're going to work together. It should be that way, right? And I'll be honest with you, our landlord, Dr. Kim, has been wonderful with us. So I'm not here to complain about my landlord. He has been a class act throughout this whole thing. And we have been really lucky because I have not heard many of my peers say anything like that. So we have been really, really lucky. But when I think about it, like, you know, if we close, that impact doesn't just affect me. It's going to affect Ola Clark, who's a single mother of four, who started a porter service when I asked her to, because she was such a great cleaning lady. My then girlfriend, now wife, when we were moving in together, said, if we are going to move in together, we're gonna need to get someone who's gonna clean the apartment regularly, because you always complain about cleaning, because, you know, you break down a bar 5-6 nights a week. The last thing you wanna do when you get home on a day off is scrub a tub, right? So I was like, I don't know, you know, this is gonna be, so why don't we just get someone in there? We found an amazing woman. She was so freaking fantastic. A single mom of four from Trinidad, just this wonderful, incredible, one of the most hardworking women I've ever met. And when it was time for me to open a bar, I said, Ola, if you can find people who can work overnight shifts, there is a whole lot of bars out there. Do a good job with pouring rivers and we'll see if we can't get you more business. And she set up a different part of her cleaning business. She'd been doing some commercial work in like retail spaces and offices, but this was a very different side of it. So we helped her set that up. You know, like, I don't want to not give her money. I know her kids, they're wonderful people. Like, we want to keep supporting local businesses like this. And that's that kind of economic impact that gets just, it doesn't even get acknowledged when people are like, oh yeah, those dens of iniquity.
Like, yeah, those are like the soft numbers, right? They're hard to define. But the fact is, you just described that not only do you bias towards other small businesses, you're willing to look into creating a small business to fill the need that you seek.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that can be a great impetus for people. If someone says, well, I didn't know if that was a thing, you're like, no, I'm telling you it's a thing. There's money to be made there, you know. It'll take some more work, but if you can put in some work and find some good people, then do a good job in, you know, use us as a trial run. And if anyone ever says, hey, I'm looking for a porter, I'll be like, I've got just the one for you. And hopefully we can keep drumming this up. So, you know, we are always, as small business owners, helping set up local distillers, local brewers, like we're pumping money back in to our local economies in ways that I don't feel is being appreciated or discussed. And it's really, it's painful because, I don't know, man, I grew up in Miami. Miami is a super late night town, you know, and people don't get into the shower to go out until like 11 o'clock on a, you know, in Miami. Like, I mean, it's a very, very late night city. You know, it's very, very late night. And I love that. And I remember when I moved to Boston when I was 19. And I remember the first time I went to a club, it was like 1:30 and all the lights came on. I was like, oh shit, is there like a fire drill? Like, what's going on? Like, what's happening? So like, you know, they're like, no, you have to leave your drink. And I go out the door, and on my way out, I asked the bouncer, I'm like, dude, how long do you think this is going to last? Like, when do we get back in? They're like, dude, we're closed. Like, what? But this is a club. It's 1:30. Why? I just got here an hour ago and I thought I was here early. Like, oh no. This is the end of your night here. You know, and like that, then I discovered there was a great after hours bar scene in Boston that helped. But New York is one of those like all night cities, right? That's always been one of the appeals. The city that never sleeps, right? It's an integral part of the global reputation of what it is that brings people to move here, right? If you're a kid in Scranton, Pennsylvania or Lubbock, Texas, right? You're looking around your hometown thinking, this is not my place. These are not my people. You know, I wanna go to a city where I can pursue my dream of being a burlesque performer or an aerialist or a DJ or a choreographer or a performance artist or a musician. A lighting designer, a makeup artist, a set builder, right? I mean, there's a million things that could draw someone here, right? And a lot of the time, that thing that they're coming to pursue may not even be their actual job. It's just the passion that they're pursuing. They're not even lucky enough to be able to make a living doing the thing that they moved here to do. So what do they usually end up doing? They end up working in bars and restaurants and nightclubs as well. Right, so these people are doubly fucked because now not only can they not do the thing that brought them to New York, right? They have lost the House of Yes where they could do a performance. They've lost elsewhere where they used to go and do this thing. Like, they've lost these spaces, you know? Like, if you were a local DJ and you could count on maybe spinning at Jupiter Disco, you know, every other week, then, you know, that was a place where you were able to find a community and create a community around there, right? I mean, a New York City without artists is not a terribly interesting New York City. I don't think anyone is going to look at a New York City that is full of chain restaurants and bars and, you know, and tech startup engineers and think, oh, wow, I can't wait to move to that exorbitantly expensive yet bland city. Like, yeah. Who wants that? No one wants that.
Certainly,
right?
Certainly none of us.
No.
And likely not many of our listeners. But hopefully this episode will penetrate through to folks who are outside of our bubble and they can have a better understanding. And I really appreciate your candor and the way you've been really honest about talking about all this. Do you have any kind of silver lining? What do you think we can do? Is there action we can take?
Well, there are some groups that are trying to do some good work. New York has recently, I think in the last year and a half, Ariel Palitz is the nightlife mayor, effectively. There is the Office of Nightlife, which is a very recently created part of our local government. And she used to run, I think it was Karma in the East Village. I forget what club it was. So, you know, she understands the business. She understands what's going on in there. She's an ally in this fight. You obviously have, you know, groups that have been doing work in a more general way, like the New York City Hospitality Alliance, the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation. But then also you have stuff like the NYC Nightlife United and NYC Nightlife Advisory Board, which are also doing really good work in a slightly more focused on this kind of venue thing. The New York Independent Venue Association is another really great one. And Brooklyn Allied Bars and Restaurants is another great one to seek out and support. And obviously within all that, you also have stuff like the Restaurants Act that is, you know, currently stalled out in Congress. There is the Restart Act, which is kind of that near term fix to fix the PPP program. But really, I think there's a lot of things that we can start pressuring our local and national politicians to consider. I think we can certainly think about, if there's no political capital to be spent on a direct handout or on a loan with fewer stipulations than kind of the way the PPP was set up, which was really for factory owners, not for other types of businesses. I think that would obviously be a great thing. PPP was very challenging for small businesses because of the ongoing lack of clarity, right? From the gift and how you were going to get it. I mean, that initial application process was so complicated. It was so difficult, the numbers you had to pull together, that if you're an average small business owner, especially if English is not your first language, trying to pull that stuff together is just not gonna happen, right? So once you, even if you were able to get the application, maybe you were able to get the money, now there is so much opacity around how it's being forgiven, what's going on. The banks were the middlemen in this. Don't even have answers. You have loan officers at banks who are like shrugging their shoulders at you, like, yeah, they haven't really told us either. So no one is being clear on this. So like, just even clearing these things up and being public and proactive about getting this information out there so that it's usable, because if you are already racking up debt and now you have this thing that you were hoping would be forgiven, you know, you really want to make sure that you know if that's going to be forgiven or not. Right. So it could be the
straw that breaks the camel's back.
Exactly. And, you know, look, again, if you don't want to give money to, you know, the bar owners or the nightclub owners, OK, I get that. I see where that could be a hard sell when there's so much money that needs to go to other things as well. Right. I get that. But how about an arrangement where money can go to landlords for these operations so that they're not going into debt simply paying their rent on venues that aren't allowed to be open, or more directly to the banks that are holding the mortgages on those buildings that those landlords are, you know, desperate to not lose their stake in, right? So again, there's a way that we can do this where I'm not saying give me a handout. I'm saying give me an opportunity to allow my business to survive long enough for me to start ramping it back up and doing those things, right? Removing personal guarantees on a lot of these like leases. I mean, I think it was Gabe Stolman from Little Wisco Group who had this terrifying letter. I mean, it was fucking heartbreaking about how scared he was that he was going to be held personally liable for the balance on the leases of these businesses that were shuttered without his control. And he's like, these landlords want to hold me on the hook for the balance of these leases. Like, that's going to put me into unbelievable amounts of personal debt. Like, that's insane. Like, we should not be worried about being saddled with crippling personal debt that would basically remove our ability to, whenever we move past this, actually try to give it another go. Again, I mean, there's got to be some humanity into this legislation, because the amount of people that this affects is enormous. And then we've seen how big an economic driver these small businesses are, right? So, I mean, if there's 4,000 or 5,000 of them in here and you start doing the multiplication on the numbers that I gave you for my kind of small potatoes bar, we're representing a lot of money. And I feel like that's not getting emphasized enough. Like, I want all those restaurants to be able to come back. But I feel like the bars and the clubs really do have their place, you know? These are things that it's sometimes hard to quantify what it is that made those places resonate so much for you. But I mean, I think for a lot of people, they end up being safe spaces, you know? And I think that can be a hard thing to find in a big alienating city of 8.5 million people. But I think people, when they find it in the city, they gravitate. And that could be your local, you know, your local dive bar where they've got the beer cap popped off by the time your second foot hits the ground. You know, maybe it was that club that always was introducing you to new genres of music. You know, it could be a place where you were able to find, you know, people who were like you. Maybe it's a queer community, it's a trans community, and you're able to feel safe and accepted. And, you know, like, that's a place for you to be there. Like, that's where those things happen. They happen in nightlife. And those are incredibly important places for marginalized groups, for struggling groups, we can't make the city just about real estate developers and iBankers. That's not an interesting New York City, agreed, right?
Joaquin, we're out of time, but man, this has been a powerfully informative and somewhat emotional episode. And I can tell you have so much more to say, and we want to hear it. So I'm gonna say maybe continue celebrating what we've been celebrating this past week and your birthday, and let's maybe get you back on the show in a couple of weeks to talk about what the future holds. I think we got right up to today, and I'd love to continue the conversation to talk to you about what the future holds. But as it stands, we are out of time on this episode of The Speakeasy. Thanks so much for tuning in, everybody, and stay tuned for the next episode. We'll see you soon. Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Thanks, Joaquin.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.